Listening Library presents Inheritance, or The Vault of Souls. Inheritance, Book 4, by Christopher Paolini. Read for you by Gerard Doyle. With an exclusive interview between Christopher Paolini and his editor, Michelle Fry, immediately following the program. Into the breach. The dragon Saphira roared, and the soldiers before her quailed.
With me!
Shouted Aragorn. He lifted Brisinger over his head, holding it aloft for all to see. The blue sword flashed bright and iridescent, stark against the wall of black clouds building in the west.
For the Varden!
An arrow whizzed past him. He paid it no mind. The warriors gathered at the base of the slope of rubble Aragorn and Saphira were standing upon, answered him with a single, full-throated bellow.
The Varden!
They brandished their own weapons and charged forward, scrambling up the tumbled blocks of stone. Aragorn turned his back to the men. On the other side of the mound lay a wide courtyard. 200 of the Empire's soldiers stood huddled within. Behind them rose a tall, dark keep with narrow slits for windows and several square towers, the tallest of which had a lantern shining in its upper rooms. Somewhere within the keep, Aragorn knew, was Lord Bradburn, governor of Bellatona, the city the Varden had been fighting to capture for several long hours. With a cry, Aragorn leaped off the rubble toward the soldiers. The men shuffled backward, although they kept their spears and pikes trained on the ragged hole Saphira had torn in the castle's outer wall. Aragorn's right ankle twisted as he landed. He fell to his knee and caught himself on the ground with his sword hand. One of the soldiers seized the opportunity to dart out of formation and stab his spear at Aragorn's exposed throat. Aragorn parried the thrust with a flick of his wrist, swinging Brisinger faster than either a human or an elf could follow. The soldier's face grew slack with fear as he realized his mistake. He tried to flee, but before he could move more than a few inches, Aragorn lunged forward and took him in the gut. With a pennant of blue and yellow flame streaming from her maw, Saphira jumped into the courtyard after Aragorn. He crouched and tensed his legs as she struck the paved ground. The impact shook the entire courtyard. Many of the chips of glass that formed a large, colourful mosaic in front of the keep popped loose and flew spinning upward like coins bounced off a drum. Above, a pair of shutters banged open and closed in a window of the building. The elf Arya accompanied Saphira. Her long black hair billowed wildly around her angular face as she sprang off the pile of rubble. Lines of splattered blood striped her arms and neck. Gore smeared the blade of her sword. She alit with a soft scuff of leather against stone. Her presence heartened Aragorn. There was no one else whom he would rather have fighting alongside him and Saphira. She was, he thought, the perfect shieldmate. He loosed a quick smile at her, and Arya responded in kind, her expression fierce and joyous. In battle, her reserved demeanor vanished, replaced by an openness that she rarely displayed elsewhere. Aragorn ducked behind his shield as a rippling sheet of blue fire appeared between them. From beneath the rim of his helm, he watched as Saphira bathed the cowering soldiers in a torrent of flames that flowed around them, yet caused them no harm. A line of archers on the battlements of the castle keep let fly a volley of arrows at Saphira. The heat above her was so intense that a handful of the arrows burst into fire in midair and crumbled to ash, while the magical wards Aragorn had placed around Saphira deflected the rest. One of the stray arrows rebounded off Aragorn's shield with a hollow thud, denting it. The plume of flame suddenly enveloped three of the soldiers, killing them so quickly they did not even have time to scream. The other soldiers clustered in the center of the inferno, the blades of their spears and pikes reflecting flashes of bright blue light. Try though she might, Saphira could not so much as singe the survivors. At last, she abandoned her efforts and closed her jaws with a definitive snap. The fire's absence left the courtyard startlingly quiet. It occurred to Aragorn, as it had several times before, that whoever had given the soldiers their wards must have been a skilled and powerful magician. Was it Murtagh? He wondered. If so, why aren't he and Thorne here to defend Bellatona? Doesn't Galba Torix care to keep control of his cities? Aragorn ran forward and with a single stroke of Brisinger lopped off the tops of a dozen pole arms as easily as he had flicked off the seed heads of barley stalks when he was younger. He slashed the nearest soldier across the chest, slicing through his mail as if it were the flimsiest of cloth. A fountain of blood arose. Then Aragorn stabbed the next soldier in line and struck the soldier to his left with his shield, knocking the man into three of his companions and bowling them over. The soldiers' reactions seemed slow and clumsy to Aragorn as he danced through their ranks, cutting them down with impunity. Saphira waded into the fray to his left, batting the soldiers into the air with her enormous paws, lashing them with her spiked tail and biting and killing them with a shake of her head. While to his right, Arya was a blur of motion, every swing of her sword signalling death for another servant of the Empire. When Aragorn spun around to evade a pair of spears, he saw the fur-covered elf Blodgarm close behind, as well as the 11 other elves whose task it was to guard him and Saphira. Farther back, the Varden poured into the courtyard through the gap in the castle's outer wall. But the men refrained from attacking. It was too dangerous to go anywhere near Saphira. Neither she nor Aragorn nor the elves required assistance in disposing of the soldiers. The battle soon swept Aragorn and Saphira apart, carrying them to opposite ends of the courtyard. Aragorn was not concerned. Even without her wards, Saphira was more than capable of defeating a large group of 20 or 30 humans by herself. A spear thudded against Aragorn's shield, bruising his shoulder. He whirled toward the thrower, a big, scarred man, missing his lower front teeth, and sprinted at him. The man struggled to draw a dagger from his belt. At the last moment, Aragorn twisted, tensed his arms and chest, and rammed his sore shoulder into the man's sternum. The force of the impact drove the soldier backward several yards, whereupon he collapsed, clutching at his heart. Then a hail of black-fletched arrows fell, killing or injuring many of the soldiers. Aragorn shied away from the missiles and covered himself with his shield, even though he was confident his magic would protect him. It would not do to become careless. He never knew when an enemy spellcaster might fire an enchanted arrow that could breach his wards. A bitter smile twisted Aragorn's lips. The archers above had realized that their only hope of victory lay in somehow killing Aragorn and the elves, no matter how many of their own they had to sacrifice to do so. "You're too late," thought Aragorn with grim satisfaction. "You should have left the Empire while you still had the chance." The onslaught of clattering arrows gave him the chance to rest for a moment, which he welcomed. The attack on the city had begun at daybreak, and he and Saphira had been at its forefront the whole while. Once the arrows ceased, Aragorn transferred Brisinger to his left hand, picked up one of the soldiers' spears, and heaved it at the archers 40 feet above. As Aragorn had discovered, spears were difficult to throw accurately without substantial practice. It did not surprise him then when he missed the man he was aiming for. But he was surprised when he missed the entire line of archers on the battlements. The spear sailed over them and shattered against the castle wall overhead. The archers laughed and jeered, making rude gestures. A swift movement at the periphery of his vision caught Aragorn's attention. He looked just in time to see Arya launch her own spear at the archers. It impaled two who were standing close together. Then Arya pointed at the men with her sword and said, "Brisinger!" And the spear burst into emerald green fire. The archers shrank from the burning corpses and as one fled from the battlements, crowding through the doorways that led to the upper levels of the castle. "That's not fair," Aragorn said. "I can't use that spell, not without my sword flaring up like a bonfire." Arya gazed at him with a faint hint of amusement. The fighting continued for another few minutes, whereupon the remaining soldiers either surrendered or tried to flee. Aragorn allowed the 5 men in front of him to run away. He knew they would not get far. After a quick examination of the bodies that lay sprawled around him, to confirm that they were indeed dead, he looked back across the courtyard. Some of the Varden had opened the gates in the outer wall and were carrying a battering ram through the street leading to the castle. Others were assembled in ragged lines next to the keep door, ready to enter the castle and confront the soldiers within. Among them stood Aragorn's cousin Roran, gesturing with his ever-present hammer while he issued orders to the detachment under his command. At the far end of the courtyard, Saphira crouched over the corpses of her kills, the area around her a shambles. Beads of blood clung to her gem-like scales, the spots of red in startling contrast to the blue of her body. She threw back her spiky head and roared her triumph, drowning out the clamour of the city with the ferocity of her cry. Then, from inside the castle, Aragorn heard the rattle of gears and chains, followed by the scrape of heavy wooden beams being drawn back. The sounds attracted everyone's gaze to the doors of the keep. With a hollow boom, the doors parted and swung open. A thick cloud of smoke from the torches within billowed outward, causing the nearest of the Varden to cough and cover their faces. From somewhere in the depths of the gloom came the drumming of ironclad hooves against the paving stones. Then a horse and rider burst forth from the centre of the smoke. In his left hand, the rider held what Aragorn first took to be a common lance, but he soon noticed that it was made of a strange green material and had a barbed blade forged in an unfamiliar pattern. A faint glow surrounded the head of the lance, the unnatural light betraying the presence of magic. The rider tugged on the reins and angled his horse towards Saphira, who began to rear onto her hind legs in preparation for delivering a terrible, killing blow with her right front paw. Concern clutched at Aragorn. The rider was too sure of himself, the lance too different, too eerie. Though her wards ought to protect her, Aragorn was certain Saphira was in mortal danger. "I won't be able to reach her in time," he realized. He cast his mind toward the rider, but the man was so focused on his task that he did not even notice Aragorn's presence, and his unwavering concentration prevented Aragorn from gaining more than superficial access to his consciousness. Withdrawing into himself, Aragorn reviewed a half-dozen words from the ancient language and composed a simple spell to stop the galloping warhorse in his tracks. It was a desperate act, for Aragorn knew not if the rider was a magician himself or what precautions he might have taken against being attacked with magic. But Aragorn was not about to stand by idly when Saphira's life was at risk. Aragorn filled his lungs. He reminded himself of the correct pronunciation of several difficult sounds in the ancient language. Then he opened his mouth to deliver the spell. Fast as he was, the elves were faster still. Before he could utter a single word, a frenzy of low chanting erupted behind him, the overlapping voices forming a discordant and unsettling melody. "Maya," he managed to say, and then the elves' magic took effect. The mosaic in front of the horse stirred and shifted, and the chips of glass flowed like water. A long rift opened up in the ground, a gaping crevice of uncertain depth. With a loud scream, the horse plunged into the hole and pitched forward, breaking both of its front legs. As horse and rider fell, the man in the saddle drew back his arm and threw the glowing lance towards Saphira. Saphira could not run, she could not dodge, so she swung a paw at the dart, hoping to knock it aside. She missed, however, by a matter of inches, and Aragorn watched with horror as the lance sank a yard or more into her chest, just under her collarbone. A pulsing veil of rage descended over Aragorn's vision. He drew upon every store of energy available to him, his body, the sapphire set in the pommel of his sword, the 12 diamonds hidden in the belt of Beloth the Wise wrapped around his waist, and the massive store within Arryn, the elf ring that graced his right hand, as he prepared to obliterate the rider, heedless of the risk. Aragorn stopped himself, however, when Blodgarm appeared, leaping over Saphira's left foreleg. The elf landed on the rider like a panther pouncing on a deer and knocked the man onto his side. With a savage twist of his head, Blodgarm tore open the man's throat with his long white teeth. A shriek of all-consuming despair emanated from a window high above the open entrance to the keep, followed by a fiery explosion that ejected blocks of stone from within the building, blocks that landed amid the assembled Varden, crushing limbs and torsos like dry twigs. Aragorn ignored the stones raining down on the courtyard and ran to Saphira, barely aware of Arya and his guards accompanying him. Other elves who had been closer were already clustering around her, examining the lance that projected from her chest. "How badly? Is she?" Aragorn said, too upset to complete his sentences. He yearned to speak to Saphira with his mind, but as long as enemy spellcasters might be in the area, he dared not expose his consciousness to her, lest his foes spy on his thoughts or assume command over his body. After a seemingly interminable wait, Wyrden, one of the male elves, said, "You may thank fate, Shadeslayer. The lance missed the major veins and arteries in her neck. It hit only muscle, and muscle we can mend. Can you remove it? Does it have any spells that would keep it from being—" "We shall attend to it, Shadeslayer." Grave as priests gathered before an altar, all the elves, save Blodgarm, placed the palms of their hands on Saphira's breast, and like a whisper of wind ghosting through a stand of willow trees, they sang. Of warmth and growth they sang, of muscle and sinew and pulsing blood they sang, and of other more arcane subjects. With what must have been an enormous effort of will, Saphira held her position throughout the incantation, though fits of tremors shook her body every few seconds. A thread of blood rolled down her chest from the shaft embedded within. As Blodgarm moved to stand next to him, Aragorn spared a glance for the elf. Gore matted the fur on his chin and neck, darkening its shade from midnight blue to solid black. "What was that?" Aragorn asked, indicating the flames still dancing in the window high above the courtyard. Blodgarm licked his lips, baring his cat-like fangs before answering. "In the moment before he died, I was able to enter the soldier's mind, and through it, the mind of the magician who was assisting him."
"You killed the magician?"
"In a manner of speaking, I forced him to kill himself. I would not normally resort to such an extravagant display of theatrics, but I was aggravated." Aragorn started forward, then checked himself when Saphira uttered a long, low moan, as without anyone touching it, the lance began to slide out of her chest. Her eyelids fluttered, and she took a series of quick, shallow breaths while the last 6 inches of the lance emerged from her body. The barbed blade, with its faint nimbus of emerald light, fell to the ground and bounced against the paving stones, sounding more like pottery than metal. When the elves stopped singing and lifted their hands from Saphira, Aragorn rushed to her side and touched her neck. He wanted to comfort her, to tell her how frightened he had been, to join his consciousness with hers. Instead, he settled for looking up into one of her brilliant blue eyes and asking, "Are you all right?" The words seemed paltry when compared with the depth of his emotion. Saphira replied with a single blink, then lowered her head and caressed his face with a gentle puff of warm air from her nostrils. Aragorn smiled. Then he turned to the elves and said, "Eka elrun ono eilfa, wil farna thonessa," thanking them in the ancient language for their help. The elves who had participated in the healing, including Arya, bowed and twisted their right hands over the center of their chests in the gesture of respect peculiar to their race. Aragorn noticed that more than half of the elves assigned to protect him and Saphira were pale, weak, and unsteady on their feet. "Fall back and rest," he told them. "You'll only get yourselves killed if you stay. Go on, that's an order." Though Aragorn was sure they hated to leave, the seven elves responded with, "As you wish, Shadeslayer," and withdrew from the courtyard, striding over the corpses and rubble. They appeared noble and dignified, even when at the limits of their endurance. Then Aragorn joined Arya and Blodgarm, who were studying the lance, a strange expression on both their faces, as if they were uncertain how they ought to react. Aragorn squatted next to them, careful not to allow any part of his body to brush against the weapon. He stared at the delicate lines carved around the base of the blade,
lines that seemed familiar to him, although he was not sure why. At the greenish haft, which was made of a material neither wood nor metal, and again at the smooth glow that reminded him of the flameless lanterns that the elves and the dwarves used to light their halls. "Is it Galbatorix's handiwork, do you think?" Aragorn asked. "Maybe he's decided he would rather kill Saphira and me instead of capturing us. Maybe he believes we've actually become a threat to him." Blodgarm smiled an unpleasant smile.
"I would not deceive myself with such fantasies, Shadeslayer. We are no more than a minor annoyance to Galbatorix. If ever he truly wanted you or any of us dead, he only needs to fly forth from Urubane and engage us directly in battle, and we would fall before him like dry leaves before a winter storm. The strength of the dragons is with him, and none can withstand his might. Besides, Galbatorix is not so easily turned from his course. Mad he may be, but cunning also, and above all else, determined. If he desires your enslavement, then he shall pursue that goal to the point of obsession, and nothing save the instinct of self-preservation shall deter him."
"In any event," said Arya, "this is not Galbatorix's handiwork. It is ours." Aragorn frowned.
"Ours? This wasn't made by the Varden?"
"Not by the Varden, but by an elf.
But..."
He stopped, trying to find a rational explanation.
"But no elf would agree to work for Galbatorix. They would rather die than..."
"Galbatorix had nothing to do with this, and even if he did, he would hardly give such a rare and powerful weapon to a man who could not better guard it. Of all the instruments of war scattered throughout Alagaesia, this is the one Galbatorix would least want us to have."
"Why?"
With a hint of a purr in his low, rich voice, Blodgarm said,
"Because, Aragorn Shadeslayer, this is a Dauthdert."
"And its name is Nirnan, the Orchid," said Arya. She pointed at the lines carved into the blade, lines that Aragorn then realized were actually stylized glyphs from the elves' unique system of writing, curving, intertwined shapes that terminated in long, thorn-like points.
"A Dauthdert?"
When both Arya and Blodgarm looked at him with incredulity, Aragorn shrugged, embarrassed by his lack of education. It frustrated him that while growing up, the elves had enjoyed decades upon decades of study with the finest scholars of their race, and yet his own uncle, Garrow, had not even taught him his letters, deeming it unimportant.
"I could only do so much reading in Ellesmere. What is it? Was it forged during the fall of the Riders, to use against Galbatorix and the Forsworn?"
Blodgarm shook his head.
"Nirnan is far, far older than that."
"The Dauthdertir," said Arya, "were born out of the fear and hate that marked the final years of our war with the dragons. Our most skilled smiths and spellcasters crafted them out of materials we no longer understand, imbued them with enchantments whose wordings we no longer remember, and named them, all 12 of them, after the most beautiful of flowers. As ugly a mismatch as ever there was, for we made them with but one purpose in mind. We made them to kill dragons."
Revulsion overtook Aragorn as he gazed at the glowing lance. "And did they?"
"Those who were present say that the dragon's blood rained from the sky like a summer downpour."
Saphira hissed, loud and sharp.
Aragorn glanced back at her for a moment and saw out of the corner of his eye that the Varden were still holding their position before the keep, waiting for him and Saphira to retake the lead in the offensive.
"All of the Dauthdertir were thought to have been destroyed or lost beyond recovery," said Blodgarm. "Obviously we were mistaken. Nirnan must have passed into the hands of the Waldgrave family, and they must have kept it hidden here in Bellatona. I would guess that when we breached the city walls, Lord Bradburn's courage failed him, and he ordered Nirnan brought from his armory in an attempt to stop you and Saphira. No doubt Galbatorix would be angry beyond reason if he knew that Bradburn had tried to kill you."
Although he was aware of the need for haste, Aragorn's curiosity would not let him leave just yet. Darth Deret or not, you still haven't explained why Galbatorix wouldn't want us to have this. He motioned toward the lance. What makes Nirnan any more dangerous than that spear over there, or even Briss? He caught himself before he uttered the entire name. Or my own sword? It was Arya who answered. It cannot be broken by any normal means, cannot be harmed by fire, and is almost completely impervious to magic, as you yourself saw. The Darth Deretir were designed to be unaffected by whatever spells the dragons might work, and to protect their wielder from the same. A daunting prospect, given the strength, complexity, and unexpected nature of dragon's magic. Galbatorix may have wrapped Shrukan and himself in more wards than anyone else in Alagazia, but it is possible that Nirnan could pass through their defences as if they don't even exist. Aragorn understood, and elation filled him. We have to... A squeal interrupted him. The sound was stabbing, slicing, shivering, like metal scraping against stone. Aragorn's teeth vibrated in sympathy, and he covered his ears with his hands, grimacing as he twisted around, trying to locate the source of the noise. Saphira tossed her head, and even through the din, he heard her whine in distress. Aragorn swept his gaze over the courtyard two separate times before he noticed a faint puff of dust rising up the wall of the keep from a foot-wide crack that had appeared beneath the blackened, partially destroyed window where Blodgarm had killed the magician. As the squeal increased in intensity, Aragorn risked lifting one of his hands off his ears to point at the crack.
Look!
He shouted to Arya, who nodded in acknowledgement. He replaced his hand over his ear. Without warning or preamble, the sound stopped. Aragorn waited for a moment, then slowly lowered his hands, for once wishing that his hearing were not quite so sensitive. Just as he did, the crack jerked open wider, spreading until it was several feet across and raced down the wall of the keep. Like a bolt of lightning, the crack struck and shattered the keystone above the doors to the building, showering the floor below with pebbles. The whole castle groaned, and from the damaged window to the broken keystone, the front of the keep began to lean outward.
Run!
Aragorn shouted at the Varden, though the men were already scattering to either side of the courtyard, desperate to get out from under the precarious wall. Aragorn took a single step forward, every muscle in his body tense as he searched for a glimpse of Rohan somewhere in the throng of warriors. At last, Aragorn spotted him, trapped behind the last group of men by the doorway, bellowing madly at them, his words lost in the commotion. Then the wall shifted and dropped several inches, leaning even farther away from the rest of the building, pelting Rohan with rocks, knocking him off balance, and forcing him to stumble backward under the overhang of the doorway. As Rohan straightened from a crouch, his eyes met Aragorn's, and in his gaze, Aragorn saw a flash of fear and helplessness, quickly followed by resignation, as if Rohan knew that no matter how fast he ran, he could not possibly reach safety in time. A wry smile touched Rohan's lips, and the wall fell. Hammerfall.
No!
Shouted Aragorn, as the wall of the keep tumbled down with a thunderous crash, burying Rohan and five other men beneath a mound of stone 20 feet high, and flooding the courtyard with a dark cloud of dust. Aragorn's shout was so loud his voice broke, and slick, copper-tasting blood coated the back of his throat. He inhaled and doubled over, coughing.
Feitner!
He gasped and waved his hand. With a sound like rustling silk, the thick grey dust parted, leaving the centre of the courtyard clear. Concerned as he was for Rohan, Aragorn barely noticed the strength the spell took from him.
No, 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 Aragorn muttered. He can't be dead. He can't. He can't. He can't.
As if repetition might make it true, Aragorn continued to think the phrase. But with every repetition, it became less a statement of fact or hope, and more a prayer to the world at large. Before him, Arya and the other warriors of the Varden stood coughing and rubbing their eyes with the palms of their hands. Many were hunched over as if expecting a blow. Others gaped at the front of the damaged keep. The rubble from the building spilled into the middle of the courtyard, obscuring the mosaic. two and a half rooms on the second story of the keep, and one on the third, the room where the magician had expired so violently, stood exposed to the elements. The chambers and their furnishings seemed dirty and rather shabby in the full light of the sun. Within, a half dozen soldiers armed with crossbows were scrambling back from the drop they now found themselves standing by. With much pushing and shoving, they hurried through the doors at the far ends of the rooms and vanished into the depths of the keep. Aragorn tried to guess the weight of a block in the pile of rubble. It must have been many hundreds of pounds. If he, Sephira, and the elves all worked together, he was sure that they could shift the stones with magic. But the effort would leave them weak and vulnerable. Moreover, it would take an impractically long time. For a moment, Aragorn thought of Gleda. The golden dragon was more than strong enough to lift the whole pile at once, but haste was of the essence, and Gleda's Eldenari would take too long to retrieve. In any case, Aragorn knew that he might not even be able to convince Gleda to talk with him, much less to help rescue Roran and the other men. Then Aragorn pictured Roran as he had appeared just before the deluge of stones and dust had hidden him from view, standing underneath the eaves of the doorway to the keep, and with a start, he realized what to do.
"Sephira, help them!" Aragorn shouted as he cast aside his shield and bounded forward.
Behind him, he heard Arya say something in the ancient language, a short phrase that might have been, "Hide this." Then she had caught up to him, running with her sword in hand, ready to fight. When he reached the base of the rubble, Aragorn leaped as high as he could. He alit with a single foot upon the slanting face of a block, and then jumped again, bounding from point to point like a mountain goat scaling the side of a gorge. He hated to risk disturbing the blocks, but climbing the pile was the fastest way to reach his destination. With one last lunge, Aragorn cleared the edge of the second story, then raced across the room. He shoved the door in front of him with such force that he broke the latch and hinges, and sent the door flying into the wall of the corridor beyond, splitting the heavy oak planks. Aragorn sprinted down the corridor. His footsteps and his breathing sounded strangely muted to him, as if his ears were filled with water. He slowed as he drew near an open doorway. Through it, he saw a study with five armed men pointing at a map and arguing. None of them noticed Aragorn. He kept running. He sped around a corner and collided with a soldier walking in the opposite direction. Aragorn's vision flashed red and yellow as his forehead struck the rim of the man's shield. He clung to the soldier, and the two of them staggered back and forth across the corridor like a pair of drunk dancers. The soldier uttered an oath as he struggled to regain his balance.
"What's wrong with you, you thrice-blasted?" he said,
and then he saw Aragorn's face, and his eyes widened.
"You!"
Aragorn balled his right hand and punched the man in the belly, directly underneath his ribcage. The blow lifted the man off his feet and smashed him into the ceiling.
"Me," Aragorn agreed, as the man dropped to the floor, lifeless.
Aragorn continued down the corridor. His already rapid pulse seemed to have doubled since he entered the keep. He felt as if his heart were about to burst out of his chest.
"Where is it?"
he thought, frantic as he glanced through yet another doorway and saw nothing but an empty room. At last, at the end of a dingy side passage, he caught sight of a winding staircase. He took the stairs five at a time, heedless of his own safety, as he descended toward the first story, pausing only to push a startled archer out of his way. The stairs ended, and he emerged into a high-vaulted chamber, reminiscent of the cathedral in Drasleona. He spun around, gathering quick impressions. Shields and arms and red pennants hung on the walls, narrow windows close under the ceiling, torches mounted in wrought-iron brackets, empty fireplaces, long, dark trestle tables stacked along both sides of the hall, and a dais at the head of the room, where a robed and bearded man stood before a high-backed chair. Aragorn was in the main hall of the castle. To his right, between him and the doors that led to the entrance of the keep, was a contingent of 50 or more soldiers. The gold thread in their tunics glittered as they stirred with surprise.
"Kill him!"
the robed man ordered, sounding more frightened than lordly.
"Whosoever kills him shall have a third of my treasure. So I promise."
A terrible frustration welled up inside Aragorn at being delayed once again. He tore his sword from its scabbard, lifted it over his head, and shouted,
"Brisingr!"
with a rush of air, a cocoon of wraith-like blue flames sprang into existence around the blade, running up toward the tip. The heat from the fire warmed Aragorn's hand, arm, and the side of his face. Then Aragorn lowered his gaze to the soldiers.
"Move," he growled.
The soldiers hesitated a moment more, then turned and fled. Aragorn charged forward, ignoring the panicked laggards within reach of his burning sword. One man tripped and fell before him. Aragorn jumped completely over the soldier, not even touching the tassel on his helm. The wind from Aragorn's passage tore at the flames on the blade, stretching them out behind the sword like the mane of a galloping horse. Hunching his shoulders, Aragorn bawled past the double doors that guarded the entrance to the main hall. He dashed through a long, wide chamber, edged with rooms full of soldiers, as well as gears, pulleys, and other mechanisms used for raising and lowering the gates of the keep, and then ran full tilt into the portcullis that blocked the way to where Rohan had been standing when the keep wall collapsed. The iron grating bent as Aragorn slammed into it, but not enough to break the metal. He staggered back a step. He again channeled energy stored within the diamonds of his belt, the belt of Bellowed the Wise, and into Brisinger, emptying the gemstones of their precious store as he stoked the sword's fire to an almost unbearable intensity. A wordless shout escaped him as he drew back his arm and struck at the portcullis. Orange and yellow sparks sprayed him, pitting his gloves and tunic and stinging his exposed flesh. A drop of molten iron fell sizzling onto the tip of his boot. With a twitch of his ankle, he shook it off. Three cuts he made, and a man-sized section of the portcullis fell inward. The severed ends of the grating glowed white-hot, lighting the area with their soft radiance. Aragorn allowed the flames rising from Brisinger to die out as he proceeded through the opening he had created. First to the left, then to the right, and then to the left again he ran, as the passage alternated directions, the convoluted path designed to slow the advance of troops if they managed to gain access to the keep. When he rounded the last corner, Aragorn saw his destination, the debris-choked vestibule. Even with his elf-like vision, he could make out only the largest shapes in the darkness, for the falling stones had extinguished the torches on the walls. He heard an odd huffing and scuffling, as if some sort of clumsy beast were rooting through the rubble.
"Nena," said Aragorn.
A directionless blue light illuminated the space, and there before him, covered in dirt, blood, ash, and sweat, with his teeth bared in a fearsome snarl, appeared Rohan, grappling with a soldier over the corpses of two others. The soldier winced at the sudden brightness, and Rohan took advantage of the man's distraction to twist and push him to his knees, whereupon he grabbed the soldier's dagger from his belt and drove it up under the corner of his jaw. The soldier kicked twice, and then was still. Panting for breath, Rohan rose from the body, blood dripping from his fingers. He looked over at Aragorn with a curiously glazed expression.
"About time, you," he said,
and then his eyes rolled back into his head as he fainted.
Shadows on the Horizon. In order to catch Rohan before he struck the floor, Aragorn had to drop Brisinger, which he was reluctant to do. Nevertheless, he opened his hand, and the sword clattered against the stones, even as Rohan's weight settled into his arms.
"Is he badly hurt?" Arya asked.
Aragorn flinched, surprised to find her and Blodgarm standing next to him.
"I don't think so."
He patted Rohan's cheeks several times, smearing the dust on his skin. In the flat, ice-blue glare of Aragorn's spell, Rohan appeared gaunt, his eyes surrounded by bruised shadows and his lips a purplish colour, as if stained with the juice from berries.
"Come on, wake up!"
After a few seconds, Rohan's eyelids twitched. Then he opened them and looked at Aragorn, obviously confused. Relief washed over Aragorn, so strong he could taste it.
"You blacked out for a moment," he explained. "Ah, he's alive,"
Aragorn said to Saphira, risking a brief moment of contact. Her pleasure was obvious.
"Good. I will stay here and help the elves move the stones away from the building. If you need me, shout, and I'll find a way to reach you."
Roran's mail tinkled as Aragorn helped him to his feet.
"What of the others?"
Aragorn asked, and gestured toward the mound of rubble. Roran shook his head.
"Are you sure?"
"No one could have survived under there. I only escaped because I was partially sheltered by the eaves."
"And you?
You're all right?" Aragorn asked.
"What?"
Roran frowned, seeming distracted, as if the thought had not even occurred to him.
"I'm fine. Wrist might be broken. It's not bad."
Aragorn cast a meaningful glance at Blodgarm. The elf's features tightened with a faint display of displeasure, but he went over to Roran and in a smooth voice said,
"If I may."
He extended a hand toward Roran's injured arm. While Blodgarm labored over Roran, Aragorn picked up Brisinger, then stood guard with Arya at the entrance, in case any soldiers were so foolhardy as to launch an attack.
"There, all done," Blodgarm said.
He moved away from Roran, who rolled his wrist in a circle, testing the joint. Satisfied, Roran thanked Blodgarm, then lowered his hand and cast about the rubble-strewn floor until he found his hammer. He readjusted the position of his armor and looked out the entrance.
"I've about had my fill of this Lord Bradburn," he said, in a deceptively calm tone. "He has held his seat over long, I think, and ought to be relieved of his responsibilities. Wouldn't you agree, Arya?"
"I would," she said.
"Well then, let's find the soft-bellied old fool. I would give him a few gentle taps from my hammer in memory of everyone we have lost today."
"He was in the main hall a few minutes ago," Aragorn said, "but I doubt he stayed to await our return."
Roran nodded.
"Then we'll have to hunt him down."
And with that, he strode forward. Aragorn extinguished his illuminating spell and hurried after his cousin, holding Brisinger at the ready. Arya and Blodgarm stayed as close beside him as the convoluted passageway would allow. The chamber that the passageway led to was abandoned, as was the main hall of the castle, where the only evidence of the dozens of soldiers and officials who had populated it was a helmet that lay on the floor, rocking back and forth in ever-decreasing arcs. Aragorn and Roran ran past the marble dais, Aragorn restricting his speed so as not to leave Roran behind. They kicked down a door just to the left of the platform and rushed up the stairs beyond. At each story, they paused so that Blodgarm could search with his mind for any trace of Lord Bradburn and his retinue, but he found none. As they reached the third level, Aragorn heard a stampede of footsteps and saw a thicket of jabbing spears fill the curved archway in front of Roran. The spears cut Roran on the cheek and on his right thigh, coating his knee with blood. He bellowed like a wounded bear and rammed into the spears with his shield, trying to push his way up the last few steps and out of the stairwell. Men shouted frantically. Behind Roran, Aragorn switched Brisinger to his left hand, then reached around his cousin, grabbed one of the spears by the haft, and yanked it out of the grip of whoever was holding it. He flipped the spear around and threw it into the center of the men packed in the archway. Someone screamed, and a gap appeared in the wall of bodies. Aragorn repeated the process, and his throws soon reduced the number of soldiers enough that step by step, Roran was able to force the mass of men back. As soon as Roran won clear of the stairs, the 12 remaining soldiers scattered across a wide landing, fringed with balustrades, each man seeking room to swing his weapon without obstruction. Roran bellowed again and leaped after the nearest soldier. He parried the man's sword, then stepped past his guard and struck the man on his helm, which rang like an iron pot. Aragorn sprinted across the landing and tackled a pair of soldiers who were standing close together. He knocked them to the ground, then dispatched each of them with a single thrust of Brisinger. An axe hurtled toward him, whirling end over end. He ducked and pushed a man over a balustrade before engaging two others who were trying to disembowel him with billed pikes. Then Arya and Blodgarm were moving among the men, silent and deadly, the elves' inherent grace making the violence appear more like an artfully staged performance than the sordid struggle most fights were. In a rush of clanging metal, broken bones and severed limbs, the four of them killed the rest of the soldiers. As always, the combat exhilarated Aragorn. It felt to him like being shocked with a bucket of cold water, and it left him with a sense of clarity unequalled by any other activity. Roran bent over and rested his hands on his knees, gasping for air as if he had just finished a race. "Shall I?" asked Aragorn, gesturing at the cuts on Roran's face and thigh. Roran tested his weight on the wounded leg a few times. I can wait. Let's find Bradburn first.
Aragorn took the lead as they filed back into the stairwell and resumed their climb. At last, after another 5 minutes of searching, they found Lord Bradburn barricaded within the highest room of the keep's westernmost tower. With a series of spells, Aragorn, Arya, and Blodgarm disassembled the doors and the tower of furniture piled behind them. As they and Roran entered the chambers, the high-ranking retainers and castle guards who had gathered in front of Lord Bradburn blanched, and many began to shake. To Aragorn's relief, he only had to kill three of the guards before the rest of the group placed their weapons and shields on the floor in surrender. Then Arya marched over to Lord Bradburn, who had remained silent throughout, and said,
"Now will you order your forces to stand down? Only a few remain, but you can still save their lives."
"I would not, even if I could," said Bradburn, in a voice of such hate and sneering derision, Aragorn almost struck him. "You'll have no concessions from me, elf. I'll not give up my men to filthy, unnatural creatures such as you. Death would be preferable. And do not think you can beguile me with honeyed words. I know of your alliance with the Urgles, and I would sooner trust a snake than a person who breaks bread with those monsters."
Arya nodded and placed her hand over Bradburn's face. She closed her eyes, and for a time both she and Bradburn were motionless. Aragorn reached out with his mind, and he felt the battle of wills that was raging between them as Arya worked her way past Bradburn's defences and into his consciousness. It took a minute, but at last she gained control of the man's mind, whereupon she set about calling up and examining his memories until she discovered the nature of his wards. Then she spoke in the ancient language and cast a complex spell designed to circumvent those wards and to put Bradburn to sleep. When she finished, Bradburn's eyes closed, and with a sigh, he collapsed into her arms.
"She killed him!"
shouted one of the guards, and cries of fear and outrage spread among the men. As Aragorn attempted to convince them otherwise, he heard one of the Varden's trumpets being winded far off in the distance. Soon another trumpet sounded, this one much closer, then another, and then he caught snatches of what he would have sworn were faint, scattered cheers rising from the courtyard below. Puzzled, he exchanged glances with Arya. Then they turned in a circle, looking out each of the windows set within the walls of the chamber. To the west and south lay Bellatona. It was a large, prosperous city, one of the largest in the empire. Close to the castle, the buildings were imposing structures made of stone, with pitched roofs and oriel windows, while farther away they were constructed of wood and plaster. Several of the half-timbered buildings had caught fire during the fighting. The smoke filled the air with a layer of brown haze that stung eyes and throats. To the southwest, a mile beyond the city, was the Varden's camp. Long rows of grey woolen tents ringed by stake-lined trenches, a few brightly coloured pavilions sporting flags and pennants, and stretched out on the bare ground, hundreds of wounded men. The healers' tents were already filled to capacity. To the north, past the docks and warehouses, was Leona Lake, a vast expanse of water dotted with the occasional whitecap. Above, the wall of black clouds that was advancing from the west loomed high over the city, threatening to envelop it within the folds of rain that fell skirt-like from its underside. Blue light flickered here and there in the depths of the storm, and thunder rumbled like an angry beast. But nowhere did Aragorn see an explanation for the commotion that had attracted his attention. He and Arya hurried over to the window directly above the courtyard. Saphira and the men and elves working with her had just finished clearing away the stones in front of the keep. Aragorn whistled, and when Saphira looked up, he waved. Her long jaws parted in a toothy grin, and she blew a streamer of smoke toward him.
"Ho! What news?"
Aragorn shouted. One of the Varden standing on the castle walls raised an arm and pointed eastward.
"Shadeslayer, look! The werecats are coming! The werecats are coming!"
A cold tingle crawled down Aragorn's spine. He followed the line of the man's arm eastward, and this time he saw a host of small, shadowy figures emerging from a fold in the land several miles away.
on the other side of the Jeet River. Some of the figures went on four legs and some on two, but they were too far away for him to be sure if they were werecats.
Could it be?
Asked Arya, sounding amazed.
I don't know. Whatever they are, we'll find out soon enough.
King Cat. Aragorn stood on the dais in the main hall of the keep, directly to the right of Lord Bradburn's throne, his left hand on the pommel of Brisinger, which was sheathed. On the other side of the throne stood Jormungandr, senior commander of the Varden, holding his helmet in the crook of his arm. The hair at his temples was streaked with grey. The rest was brown, and all of it was pulled back into a long braid. His lean face bore the studiously blank expression of a person who had extensive experience waiting on others. Aragorn noticed a thin line of red running along the underside of Jormungandr's right bracer, but Jormungandr showed no sign of pain. Between them sat their leader, Nasawada, resplendent in a dress of green and yellow, which he had donned just moments before, exchanging the raiment of war for garb more suited to the practice of statecraft. She too had been marked during the fighting, as was evidenced by the linen bandage wrapped around her left hand. In a low voice that only Aragorn and Jormungandr could hear, Nasawada said, "If we can but gain their support."
"What will they want in return, though?" asked Jormungandr. "Our coffers are near empty, and our future uncertain."
Her lips barely moving, she said, "Perhaps they wish nothing more of us than a chance to strike back at Galba Torix." She paused. "But if not, we shall have to find means other than gold to persuade them to join our ranks."
"You could offer them barrels of cream," said Aragorn, which elicited a chortle from Jormungandr and a soft laugh from Nasawada.
Their murmured conversation came to an end as three trumpets sounded outside the main hall. Then a flaxen-haired page, dressed in a tunic stitched with the Varden standard, a white dragon holding a rose above a sword pointing downward on a purple field, marched through the open doorway at the far end of the hall, struck the floor with his ceremonial staff, and in a thin, warbling voice announced,
"His Most Exalted Royal Highness, Grimmer Halfpaw, King of the Werecats, Lord of the Lonely Places, Ruler of the Night Reaches, and He Who Walks Alone."
"A strange title, that. He Who Walks Alone?"
Aragorn observed to Saphira.
"But well deserved, I would guess,"
she replied, and he could sense her amusement, even though he could not see her, where she lay coiled in the castle keep. The page stepped aside, and through the doorway strode Grimmer Halfpaw in the shape of a human, trailed by four other werecats who padded close behind him on large, shaggy paws. The four resembled Solombum, the one other werecat Aragorn had seen in the guise of an animal, heavy-shouldered and long-limbed, with short, dark ruffs upon their necks and withers, tasseled ears, and black-tipped tails, which they waved gracefully from side to side. Grimmer Halfpaw, however, looked unlike any person or creature Aragorn had ever seen. At roughly 4 feet tall, he was the same height as a dwarf, but no one could have mistaken him for a dwarf, or even for a human. He had a small, pointed chin, wide cheekbones, and underneath upswept brows, slanted green eyes, fringed with wing-like eyelashes. His ragged black hair hung low over his forehead, while on the sides and back it fell to his shoulders, where it lay smooth and lustrous, much like the manes of his companions. His age was impossible for Aragorn to guess. The only clothes Grimmer wore were a rough leather vest and a rabbit-skin loincloth. The skulls of a dozen or so animals, birds, mice, and other small game, were tied to the front of the vest, and they rattled against one another as he moved. A sheathed dagger protruded at an angle from under the belt of his loincloth. Numerous scars, thin and white, marked his nut-brown skin, like scratches on a well-used table, and as his name indicated, he was missing two fingers on his left hand. They looked to have been bitten off. Despite the delicacy of his features, there was no doubt that Grimmer was male, given the hard, sinewy muscles of his arms and chest, the narrowness of his hips, and the coiled power of his stride as he sauntered down the length of the hall toward Nasawada. None of the Weercat seemed to notice the people lined up on either side of their path watching them, until Grimmer came level with the herbalist Angela, who stood next to Roran, knitting a striped tube sock with 6 needles. Grimmer's eyes narrowed as he beheld the herbalist, and his hair rippled and spiked, as did that of his 4 guards. His lips drew back to reveal a pair of curved white fangs, and to Aragorn's astonishment, he uttered a short, loud hiss. Angela looked up from the sock, her expression languid and insolent.
"Cheep, cheep," she said.
For a moment, Aragorn thought the Weercat was going to attack her. A dark flush mottled Grimmer's neck and face. His nostrils flared, and he snarled silently at her. The other Weercats settled into low crouches, ready to pounce, their ears pressed flat against their heads. Throughout the hall, Aragorn heard the slither of blades being partially drawn from their scabbards. Grimmer hissed once more, then turned away from the herbalist and continued walking. As the last Weercat in line passed Angela, he lifted a paw and took a surreptitious swipe at the strand of yarn that drooped from Angela's needles, just like a playful house cat might. Saphira's bewilderment was equal to Aragorn's own.
"Cheep, cheep," she asked.
He shrugged, forgetting that she could not see him. Who knows why Angela does or says anything? At last, Grimmer arrived before Nasawada. He inclined his head ever so slightly, displaying with his bearing the supreme confidence, even arrogance, that was the sole province of cats, dragons, and certain high-born women.
"Lady Nasawada," he said.
His voice was surprisingly deep, more akin to the low, coughing roar of a wildcat than the high-pitched tones of the boy he resembled. Nasawada inclined her head in turn.
"King Halfpaw, you are most welcome to the Varden, you and all your race. I must apologize for the absence of our ally, King Orin of Cirda. He could not be here to greet you as he wished, for he and his horsemen are even now busy defending our westward flank from a contingent of Galbatorix's troops."
"Of course, Lady Nasawada,"
said Grimmer. His sharp teeth flashed as he spoke.
"You must never turn your back on your enemies."
"Even so. And to what do we owe the unexpected pleasure of this visit, Your Highness? Weercats have always been noted for their secrecy and their solitude, and for remaining apart from the conflicts of the age, especially since the fall of the Riders. One might even say that your kind has become more myth than fact over the past century. Why, then, do you now choose to reveal yourselves?" Grimmer lifted his right arm and pointed at Aragorn with a crooked finger topped by a claw-like nail.
"Because of him," growled the Weercat. "One does not attack another hunter until he has shown his weakness, and Galbatorix has shown his. He will not kill Aragorn Shadeslayer or Saphira Bjartskula. Long have we waited for this opportunity, and seize it we will. Galbatorix will learn to fear and hate us, and at the last he will realize the extent of his mistake, and know that we were the ones responsible for his undoing. And how sweet that revenge will taste, as sweet as the marrow of a tender young boar. Time has come, human, for every race, even Weercats, to stand together and prove to Galbatorix that he has not broken our will to fight. We would join your army, Lady Nasawada, as free allies, and help you achieve this."
What Nasawada was thinking, Aragorn could not tell, but he and Saphira were impressed by the Weercat's speech. After a brief pause, Nasawada said,
"Your words fall most pleasantly upon my ears, Your Highness. But before I can accept your offer, there are answers I must have of you, if you are willing."
With an air of unshakable indifference, Grimmer waved a hand.
"I am."
Your race has been so secretive and so elusive. I must confess I had not heard tell of your highness until this very day. As a point of fact, I did not even know that your race had a ruler.
I am not a king like your kings, said Grimmer. Werecats prefer to walk alone, but even we must choose a leader when to war we go.
I see. Do you speak for your whole race, then, or only for those who travel with you? Grimmer's chest swelled, and his expression became, if possible, even more self-satisfied.
I speak for all of my kind, Lady Nasawada, he purred. Every able-bodied werecat in Alagasia, save those who are nursing, has come here to fight. There are few of us, but none can equal our ferocity in battle. And I can also command the One Shapes, although I cannot speak for them, for they are as dumb as other animals. Still, they will do what we ask of them.
One Shapes? Nasawada inquired.
Those you know as cats, those who cannot change their skins as we do.
And you command their loyalty?
Aye, they admire us, as is only natural.
If what he says is true, Aragorn commented to Saphira, the werecats could prove to be incredibly valuable. Then Nasawada said, And what is it you desire of us, in exchange for your assistance, King Halfpaw? She glanced at Aragorn and smiled, then added, We can offer you as much cream as you want, but beyond that our resources are limited. If your warriors expect to be paid for their troubles, I fear they will be sorely disappointed.
Cream is for kittens, and gold holds no interest for us, said Grimmer.
As he spoke, he lifted his right hand and inspected his nails with a heavy-lidded gaze.
Our terms are thus. Each of us will be given a dagger to fight with, if we do not already have one. Each of us shall have 2 suits of armor made to fit, one for when on 2 legs we stand, and one for when on 4. We need no other equipment than that. No tents, no blankets, no plates, no spoons. Each of us will be promised a single duck, grouse, chicken, or similar bird per day, and every second day a bowl of freshly chopped liver. Even if we do not choose to eat it, the food will be set aside for us. Also, should you win this war, then whoever becomes your next king or queen, and all who claim that title thereafter, will keep a padded cushion next to their throne, in a place of honour, for one of us to sit on, if we so wish.
You bargain like a dwarven lawgiver, said Nasawada in a dry tone. She leaned over to Jormungandr, and Aragorn heard her whisper, Do we have enough liver to feed them all?
I think so, Jormungandr replied in an equally hushed voice, but it depends on the size of the bowl.
Nasawada straightened in her seat. 2 sets of armor is 1 too many, King Halfpaw. Your warriors will have to decide whether they want to fight as cats or as humans, and then abide by the decision. I cannot afford to outfit them for both. If Grimmer had had a tail, Aragorn was sure it would have twitched back and forth. As it was, the werecat merely shifted his position.
Very well, Lady Nasuada.
There is one more thing. Galbatorix has spies and killers hidden everywhere. Therefore, as a condition of joining the Varden, you must consent to allow one of our spellcasters to examine your memories, so we may assure ourselves that Galbatorix has no claim on you. Grimmer sniffed.
You would be foolish not to. If anyone is brave enough to read our thoughts, let them. But not her!
And he twisted to point at Angela.
Never her.
Nasawada hesitated, and Aragorn could see that she wanted to ask why, but restrained herself. So be it.
I will send for magicians at once, that we may settle this matter without delay. Depending on what they find, and it will be nothing untoward, I'm sure, I am honoured to form an alliance between you and the Varden, King Halfpaw." At her words, all of the humans in the hall broke out cheering and began to clap, including Angela. Even the elves appeared pleased. The Weircats, however, did not react, except to tilt their ears backward in annoyance at the noise.